somewhere in the neighborhood, in treasure chests that, when opened, would be gleaming with gold, and were waiting only for us to find them. Then, I don't know why, things changed, and we began to link school to wealth. We thought that if we studied hard, we would be able to write books, and that the books would make us rich. Wealth was still the glitter of gold coins stored in countless chests. But to get there, all you had to do was go to school and write a book. "Let's write one together," Leela said once, and that filled me with joy. Maybe the idea took root when she discovered that the author of Little Women had made so much money that she had given some of it to her family. But I wouldn't promise. We argued about it. I said we could start right after the admission test. She agreed, but then she couldn't wait. While I had a lot to study because of the afternoon lessons with Spagnuolo and the teacher, she was freer. She set to work and wrote a novel without me. I was hurt when she brought it to me to read, but I didn't say anything. In fact, I held in check my disappointment and was full of congratulations. There were 10 sheets of graph paper, folded and held together with a dressmaker's pin. It had a cover drawn in pastels, and the title, I remember, was The Blue Fairy. How exciting it was. How many difficult words there were. I told her to let the teacher read it. She didn't want to. I begged her. I offered to give it to her. Although she wasn't sure, she agreed. One day, when I was at Maestra Oliviero's house for our lesson, I took advantage of Giliola being in the bathroom to take out The Blue Fairy. I said it was a wonderful novel written by Leela, and that Leela wanted her to read it. But the teacher, who for 5 years had been enthusiastic about everything Leela did, except when she was bad, replied coldly, "Tell Cirullo that she would do well to study for the diploma instead of wasting time." And although she kept Leela's novel, she left it on the table without even giving it a glance. That attitude confused me. What had happened? Was she angry with Leela's mother? Had her rage extended to Leela herself? Was she upset about the money that the parents of my friend wouldn't give her? I didn't understand. A few days later, I cautiously asked her if she had read The Blue Fairy. She answered in an unusual tone, obscurely, as if only she and I could truly understand. "Do you know what the plebes are, Greco?" "Yes, the people, the tribunes of the plebes, are the Gracchi."
"The plebes are quite a nasty thing."
"Yes."
"And if one wishes to remain a plebeian, he, his children, the children of his children deserve nothing." "Forget Cirullo, and think of yourself." Maestro Oliviero never said anything about the Blue Fairy. Leela asked about it a couple of times, then she let it go. She said grimly, "As soon as I have time, I'll write another. That one wasn't good."
It was wonderful.
It was terrible.
But she became less lively, especially in class. Probably because she realized that the teacher had stopped praising her, and sometimes seemed irritated by her excesses of virtuosity. When it came time for the competition at the end of the year, she was still the best, but without her old impudence. At the end of the day, the principal presented to those remaining in competition, Leela, Giliola, and me, an extremely difficult problem that he had invented himself. Giliola and I struggled in vain. Leela, narrowing her eyes to cracks, applied herself. She was the last to give up. She said, with a timidity unusual for her, that the problem couldn't be solved because there was a mistake in the premise,
but she didn't know what it was. Maestra Oliviero scolded her harshly. I saw Lila standing at the blackboard, chalk in hand, very small and pale, assaulted by volleys of cruel phrases. I felt her suffering. I couldn't bear the trembling of her lower lip and nearly burst into tears. When one cannot solve a problem, the teacher concluded coldly, one does not say there is a mistake in the problem. One says, I am not capable of solving it. The principal was silent. As far as I remember, the day ended there. 16. Shortly before the final test in elementary school, Lila pushed me to do another of the many things that I would never have had the courage to do by myself. We decided to skip school and cross the boundaries of the neighborhood. It had never happened before. As far back as I could remember, I had never left the four-story white apartment buildings, the courtyard, the parish church, the public gardens. I had never felt the urge to. Trains passed continuously on the other side of the scrubland. Trucks and cars passed up and down along the stradone. And yet I can't remember a single occasion when I asked myself, my father, my teacher, where are the cars going? The trucks, the trains, to what city? To what world? Nor had Lila appeared particularly interested. But this time she organized everything. She told me to tell my mother that after school we were all going to the teacher's house for a party to mark the end of the school year. And although I tried to remind her that the teachers had never invited all us girls to their houses for a party, she said that that was the very reason we should say it. The event would seem so exceptional that none of our parents would be bold enough to go to school and ask if it was true or not. As usual, I trusted her, and things went just as she had said. At my house, everyone believed it, not only my father and my sister and brothers, but even my mother. The night before, I couldn't sleep. What was beyond the neighborhood, beyond its well-known perimeter? Behind us rose a thickly wooded hill, and a few structures in the shelter of the gleaming railroad tracks. In front of us, beyond the stradone, stretched a pitted road that skirted the ponds. To the right was a strip of treeless countryside, under an enormous sky. To the left was a tunnel with three entrances, but if you climbed up to the railroad tracks, on clear days you could see, beyond some low houses and walls of tufa and patches of thick vegetation, a blue mountain with one low peak and one a little higher, which was called Vesuvius and was a volcano. But nothing that we had before our eyes every day, or that could be seen if we clambered up the hill, impressed us. Trained by our schoolbooks to speak with great skill about what we had never seen, we were excited by the invisible. Lila said that in the direction of Vesuvius was the sea. Reno, who had been there, had told her that the water was blue and sparkling, a marvelous sight. On Sundays, especially in summer, but often, too, in winter, he went with friends to swim, and he had promised to take her there. He wasn't the only one, naturally, who had seen the sea. Others we knew had also seen it. Once, Nino Saratore and his sister Marisa had talked about it, in the tone of those who found it normal to go every so often to eat tarali and seafood. Giliola Spagnuolo had also been there. She, Nino, and Marisa had, lucky for them, parents who took their children on outings far away. Not just around the corner to the public gardens in front of the parish church. Ours weren't like that. They didn't have time. They didn't have money. They didn't have the desire. It was true that I seemed to have a vague, bluish memory of the sea. My mother claimed she had taken me as a small child, when she had to have sand treatments for her injured leg. But I didn't much believe my mother. And to Leela, who didn't know anything about it, I admitted that I didn't know anything either. So she planned to do as Reno had, to set off on the road and get there by herself. She persuaded me to go with her. Tomorrow. I got up early. I did everything as if I were going to school. My bread and milk, my school bag, my smock. I waited for Leela as usual in front of the gate. Only instead of going to the right, we crossed the stradone and turned left toward the tunnel. It was early morning and already hot. There was a strong odor of earth and grass drying in the sun. We climbed among tall shrubs, on indistinct paths that led toward the tracks. When we reached an electrical pylon, we took off our smocks and put them in the school bags, which we hid in the bushes. Then we raced through the scrubland, which we knew well, and flew excitedly down the slope that led to the tunnel. The entrance on the right was very dark. We had never been inside that obscurity. We held each other by the hand and entered. It was a long passage, and the luminous circle of the exit seemed far away. Once we got accustomed to the shadowy light, we saw lines of silvery water that slid along the walls, large puddles. Apprehensively, dazed by the echo of our steps, we kept going. Then Leela let out a shout and laughed at the violent explosion of sound. Immediately, I shouted and laughed in turn. From that moment, all we did was shout, together and separately. Laughter and cries, cries and laughter, for the pleasure of hearing them amplified. The tension diminished. The journey began. Ahead of us were many hours when no one in our families would look for us. When I think of the pleasure of being free, I think of the start of that day, of coming out of the tunnel and finding ourselves on a road that went straight as far as the eye could see. The road that, according to what Reno had told Leela, if you got to the end, arrived at the sea. I felt joyfully open to the unknown. It was entirely different from going down into the cellar or up to Don Achille's house. There was a hazy sun, a strong smell of burning. We walked for a long time between crumbling walls invaded by weeds, low structures from which came voices and dialect, sometimes a clamor. We saw a horse making its way slowly down an embankment and cross the street, whinnying. We saw a young woman looking out from a balcony, combing her hair with a flea comb. We saw a lot of small, snotty children who stopped playing and looked at us threateningly. We saw a fat man in an undershirt who emerged from a tumble-down house, opened his pants, and showed us his penis. But we weren't scared of anything. Don Nicola, Enzo's father, sometimes let us pat his horse. The children were threatening in our courtyard, too. And there was old Don Mimi, who showed us his disgusting thing when we were coming home from school. For at least 3 hours, the road we were walking on did not seem different from the segment that we looked out on every day. And I felt no responsibility for the right road. We held each other by the hand. We walked side by side. But for me, as usual, it was as if Leela were 10 steps ahead and knew precisely what to do, where to go. I was used to feeling second in everything. And so I was sure that to her, who had always been first, everything was clear. The pace, the calculation of the time available for going and coming back. The route that would take us to the sea. I felt as if she had everything in her head ordered in such a way that the world around us would never be able to create disorder. I abandoned myself happily. I remember a soft light that seemed to come not from the sky, but from the depths of the earth, even though on the surface it was poor and ugly. Then we began to get tired, to get thirsty and hungry. We hadn't thought of that. Leela slowed down. I slowed down too. Two or three times I caught her looking at me, as if she had done something mean to me and was sorry. What was happening? I realized that she kept turning around, and I started turning around too. Her hand began to sweat. The tunnel, which was the boundary of the neighborhood, had been out of sight for a long time. By now, the road we had just traveled was unfamiliar to us, like the one that stretched ahead. People appeared completely indifferent to our fate. Around us was a landscape of ruin, dented tanks, burned wood, wrecks of cars, cartwheels with broken spokes, damaged furniture, rusting scrap iron. Why was Leela looking back? Why had she stopped talking? What was wrong? I looked more carefully. The sky, which at first had been very high, was as if lowered. Behind us, everything was becoming black. Large, heavy clouds lay over the trees, the light poles. In front of us, the light was still dazzling, but as if pressed on the sides by a purplish grayness that would suffocate it. In the distance, thunder could be heard. I was afraid, but what frightened me more was Leela's expression, new to me. Her mouth was open, her eyes wide. She was looking nervously ahead, back, to the side, and she was squeezing my hand hard. Is it possible, I wondered, that she's afraid? What was happening to her? The first fat drops arrived, leaving small brown stains as they hit the dusty road. Let's go back, Leela said. And the sea? It's too far. And home? Also. Then let's go to the sea. No. Why? I had never seen her so agitated. There was something she had on the tip of her tongue but couldn't make up her mind to tell me, that suddenly impelled her to drag me home in a hurry. I didn't understand. Why didn't we keep going? There was time. The sea couldn't be too far. And whether we went back home or continued to go on, we'd get wet just the same if it rained. It was a type of reasoning I had learned from her, and I was bewildered when she didn't apply it. A violet light cracked the black sky. The thunder was louder. Leela gave me a tug. I found myself running, unwillingly, back toward our own neighborhood. The wind rose. The drops fell more thickly. In a few seconds, they were transformed into a cascade of water. It occurred to neither of us to seek shelter. We ran blinded by the rain, our clothes soaked, our bare feet in worn sandals that had no purchase on the now muddy ground. We ran until we were out of breath. We couldn't keep it up. We slowed down. Lightning, thunder, a lava of rainwater ran along the sides of the road. Noisy trucks sped by, raising waves of mud. We walked quickly, our hearts in a tumult. First in a heavy downpour, then in a fine rain, finally under a gray sky. We were soaked, our hair pasted to our heads, our lips livid, eyes frightened. We went back through the tunnel. We crossed the scrubland. The bushes dripping with rain grazed us, making us shiver. We found our school bags. We put over our wet clothes the dry smocks. We set out toward home. Tense, her eyes lowered, Leela had let go of my hand. We quickly understood that things had not happened as we expected. The sky had turned black over the neighborhood just when school was over. My mother had gone to school with an umbrella to take me to the party at the teacher's. She had discovered that I wasn't there, and that there was no party. For hours she had been looking for me. When I saw from a distance her painfully limping figure, I immediately left Leela, so that she wouldn't get angry with her, and ran toward my mother. She slapped me and hit me with the umbrella, yelling that she would kill me if I did something like that again. Leela took off. At her house, no one had noticed anything. At night, my mother reported everything to my father and compelled him to beat me. He was irritated, he didn't want to, and they ended up fighting. First, he hit her. Then, angry at himself, he gave me a beating. All night, I tried to understand what had really happened. We were supposed to go to the sea, and we hadn't gone. I had been punished for nothing. A mysterious inversion of attitudes had occurred. I, despite the rain, would have continued on the road. I felt far from everything and everyone, and distance, I discovered for the first time, extinguished in me every tie and every worry. Leela had abruptly repented of her own plan. She had given up the sea. She had wanted to return to the confines of the neighborhood. I couldn't figure it out. The next day, I didn't wait for her at the gate. I went alone to school. We met in the public gardens. She discovered the bruises on my arms and asked what had happened. I shrugged. That was how things had turned out. All they did was beat you? What should they have done? They're still sending you to study Latin? I looked at her in bewilderment. Was it possible? She had taken me with her, hoping that as a punishment my parents would not send me to middle school? Or had she brought me back in such a hurry so that I would avoid that punishment? Or, I wonder today, did she want, at different moments, both things? 17. We took the final test in elementary school together. When she realized that I was also taking the admission test for middle school, she lost energy. Something happened that surprised everyone. I passed both tests with all tens, the highest marks. Leela got her diploma with nines and an 8 in arithmetic. She never said a word to me of anger or discontent. She began instead to go around with Carmela Peluso, the daughter of the carpenter gambler, as if I were no longer enough. Within a few days, we became a trio, in which, however, I, who had been first in school, was almost always the third. They talked and joked continuously with each other, or rather, Leela talked and joked. Carmela listened and was amused. When we went for a walk between the church and the Stradone, Leela was always in the middle, and the two of us on the sides. If I noticed that she tended to be closer to Carmela, I suffered and wanted to go home. In this phase, she seemed dazed, like the victim of sunstroke. It was very hot, and we often bathed our heads in the fountain. I remember her with her hair and face dripping as she talked constantly about going to school the next year. It had become her favorite subject, and she tackled it as if it were one of the stories she intended to write in order to become rich. Now, when she talked, she preferred to address Carmela Peluso, who had got her diploma with all sevens, and had not taken the admission test for middle school either. Leela was very skillful at telling stories, they all seemed true, about the school where we were going, and the teachers, and she made me laugh. She made me worry. One morning, though, I interrupted her. Leela, I said, you can't go to middle school. You didn't take the admission test. Not you, and not Carmela. She got angry. She said she would go just the same, test or no test. And Carmela? Yes, it's impossible. You'll see. But I must have rattled her. She stopped telling stories about our scholastic future and became silent. Then, with a sudden determination, she started tormenting her family, insisting that she wanted to study Latin, like Giliola Spagnuolo and me. She was especially hard on Reno, who had promised to help her but hadn't. It was pointless to explain to her that there was now nothing to do about it. She became even more unreasonable and mean. At the start of the summer, I began to have a feeling difficult to put into words. I saw that she was agitated, aggressive as she had always been, and I was pleased. I recognized her. But I also felt, behind her old habits, a pain that bothered me. She was suffering, and I didn't like her sorrow. I preferred her when she was different from me, distant from my anxieties, and the uneasiness that the discovery of her fragility brought me was transformed by secret pathways into a need of my own to be superior. As soon as I could, cautiously, especially when Carmela Peluso wasn't there, I found a way to remind her that I had gotten a better report card. As soon as I could, cautiously, I pointed out to her that I would go to middle school, and she would not. To not be second, to outdo her, for the first time seemed to me a success. She must have realized it, and she became even harsher. But toward her family, not me. Often, as I waited for her to come down to the courtyard, I heard her shouting from the windows. She hurled insults in the worst street dialect, so vulgar that listening to them made me think of order and respect. It didn't seem right to treat adults like that, or even her brother. Of course, her father, Fernando the Shoemaker, when he lost his head, turned ugly. But all fathers had fits of anger, and hers, when she didn't provoke him, was a kind, sympathetic man, a hard worker. He looked like an actor named Randolph Scott, but unrefined. He was rough, without pale colors. A black beard covered his cheeks, and he had broad, stubby hands streaked with dirt in every crease and under the nails. He joked easily. When I went to Leela's house, he took my nose between index and middle fingers and pretended to pull it off. He wanted to make me believe that he had stolen it, and that now, as his prisoner, the nose was struggling to escape and return to my face. I found this funny. But if Reno or Leela or the other children made him angry, even I, hearing him from the street, was afraid. I don't know what happened. One afternoon. In the hot weather, we stayed outside until dinner time. That day, Leela didn't show up, and I went to call her at the windows, which were on the ground floor. I cried, "Lee, Lee, Lee!" And my voice joined Fernando's extremely loud voice, his wife's loud voice, my friend's insistent voice. I could hear that something was going on, and it terrified me. From the windows came a vulgar Neapolitan and the crash of broken objects. In appearance, it was no different from what happened at my house when my mother got angry, because there wasn't enough money, and my father got angry because she had already spent the part of his wages he had given her. In reality, the difference was substantial. My father was restrained even when he was angry. He became violent quietly, keeping his voice from exploding even if the veins on his neck swelled and his eyes were inflamed. Fernando instead yelled, threw things. His rage fed on itself, and he couldn't stop. In fact, his wife's attempts to stop him increased his fury. And even if he wasn't mad at her, he ended up beating her. I insisted then in calling Leela, just to get her out of that tempest of cries, obscenities, sounds of destruction. I cried, "Lee, Lee, Lee!" But she, I heard her, kept on insulting her father. We were 10. Soon we would be 11. I was filling out. Leela remained small and thin. She was light and delicate. Suddenly the shouting stopped. And a few seconds later, my friend flew out the window, passed over my head, and landed on the asphalt behind me. I was stunned. Fernando looked out, still screaming horrible threats at his daughter. He had thrown her like a thing. I looked at her terrified while she tried to get up, and said, with an almost amused grimace, "I haven't hurt myself." But she was bleeding. She had broken her arm. 18. Fathers could do that and other things to impudent girls. Afterward, Fernando became sullen and worked more than usual. That summer, Carmela and Leela and I often passed the workshop. But while Reno always gave us a friendly nod of greeting, the shoemaker wouldn't even look at his daughter as long as her arm was in the cast. It was clear that he was sorry. His violent moments as a father were a small thing compared with the widespread violence of the neighborhood. At the Bar Salara, in the heat, between gambling losses and troublesome drunkenness, people often reached the point of disperazione, a word that in dialect meant having lost all hope, but also being broke, and hence of fights. Silvio Solara, the owner, a large man with an imposing belly, blue eyes, and a high forehead, had a dark stick behind the bar with which he didn't hesitate to strike anyone who didn't pay for his drinks, who had asked for a loan and didn't repay it within the time limit, who made any sort of agreement and didn't keep it. And often he was helped by his sons, Marcello and Michele, boys the age of Leela's brother, who hit harder than their father. Blows were given and received. Men returned home embittered by their losses, by alcohol, by debts, by deadlines, by beatings. And at the first inopportune word, they beat their families. A chain of wrongs that generated wrongs. Right in the middle of that long season, an event took place that upset everyone. But on Leela had a very particular effect. Don Achille, the terrible Don Achille, was murdered in his house in the early afternoon of a surprisingly rainy August day. He was in the kitchen and had just opened the window to let in the rain-freshened air. He had got up from bed to do so, interrupting his nap. He had on worn blue pajamas and on his feet only socks of a yellowish color, blackened at the heels. As soon as he opened the window, a gust of rain struck his face, and someone plunged a knife into the right side of his neck, halfway between the jaw and the clavicle. The blood spurted from his neck and hit a copper pot hanging on the wall. The copper was so shiny that the blood looked like an ink stain, from which, Leela told us, dripped a wavering black line. The murderer, though she inclined to a murderess, had entered without breaking in, at a time when the children were outside, and the adults, if they weren't at work, were lying down. Surely he had entered with a skeleton key. Surely he had intended to strike him in the heart while he was sleeping, but had found him awake and thrust that knife into his neck. Don Achille had turned, with the blades stuck in his neck, eyes staring and the blood pouring out and dripping all over his pajamas. He had fallen to his knees,
and then, face down, to the floor. The murder had made such an impression on Leela that almost every day, with great seriousness, always adding some new details, she compelled us to hear the story as if she had been present. Both Carmela Peluso and I, listening to her, were frightened. Carmela couldn't sleep at night. At the worst moments, when the black line of blood dripped along the copper pot, Leela's eyes became two fierce cracks. Surely she imagined that the murderer was female only because it was easier for her to identify with her. In that period, we often went to the Peluso's house to play checkers and three of a kind, for which Leela had developed a passion. Carmela's mother let us sit in the dining room, where all the furniture had been made by her husband before Don Achille took away his carpenter's tools and his shop. We sat at the table, which was placed between two sideboards with mirrors, and played. I found Carmela increasingly disagreeable, but I pretended to be her friend at least as much as I was Leela's. In fact, sometimes I even let her think that I liked her better. On the other hand, I really did like Signora Peluso. She had worked at the tobacco factory, but had recently lost her job and was always at home. Anyway, she was, for better or for worse, a cheerful, fat woman, with a large bosom and bright red cheeks. And although money was scarce, she always had something good to offer us. Also, her husband seemed more tranquil. Now he was a waiter in a pizzeria, and he tried not to go to the Bar Salata to lose at cards the little he earned. One morning, we were in the dining room playing checkers, Carmela and I against Leela. We were sitting at the table, us two on one side, she on the other. Behind Leela and behind Carmela and me were the identical dark wood sideboards with the mirrors and spiral frames. I looked at the three of us reflected to infinity, and I couldn't concentrate, both because of those images, which disturbed me, and because of the shouts of Alfredo Peluso, who that day was upset and was quarreling with his wife Giuseppina. There was a knock at the door, and Signora Peluso went to open it. Exclamations. Cries. We looked out in the hall and saw the carabinieri, figures we feared greatly. The carabinieri seized Alfredo and dragged him away. He struggled, shouted, called his children by name, Pasquale, Carmela, Ciro, Immacolata. He grabbed the furniture made with his own hands, the chairs, Giuseppina. He swore that he hadn't murdered Don Achille, that he was innocent. Carmela wept desperately. They all wept. I too began to weep. But not Leela. Leela had that look she had had years earlier for Melina, but with some difference. Now, although she remained still, she appeared to be moving with Alfredo Peluso, whose cries were hoarse and frightening. Ah! It was the most terrible thing we witnessed in the course of our childhood, and made a deep impression on me. Leela attended to Carmela and consoled her. She said to her that, if it really was her father, he had done well to kill Don Achille, but that in her opinion it wasn't him. Surely he was innocent and would soon get out of prison. They whispered together continuously, and if I approached, they moved a little farther off so that I wouldn't hear. Adolescence, the story of the shoes. 1. On December 31st of 1958, Leela had her first episode of dissolving margins. The term isn't mine. She always used it. She said that on those occasions, the outlines of people and things suddenly dissolved, disappeared.
That night, on the terrace where we were celebrating the arrival of 1959, when she was abruptly struck by that sensation, she was frightened and kept it to herself, still unable to name it. It was only years later, one night in November 1980, we were 36, were married, had children, that she recounted in detail what had happened to her then, what still sometimes happened to her, and she used that term for the first time. We were outside, on the roof terrace of one of the apartment buildings in the neighborhood. Although it was very cold, we were wearing light, low-cut dresses so that we would appear attractive. We looked at the boys, who were cheerful, aggressive, dark figures, carried away by the party, the food, the sparkling wine. They were setting off fireworks to celebrate the New Year, a ritual in which, as I will explain later, Leela had a large role, so that now she felt content watching the streaks of fire in the sky. But suddenly, she told me, in spite of the cold, she had begun to sweat. It seemed to her that everyone was shouting too loudly and moving too quickly. This sensation was accompanied by nausea, and she had had the impression that something absolutely material, which had been present around her and around everyone and everything forever, but imperceptible, was breaking down the outlines of persons and things and revealing itself. Her heart had started beating uncontrollably. She had begun to feel horror at the cries emerging from the throats of all those who were moving about on the terrace amid the smoke, amid the explosions, as if the sound obeyed new, unknown laws. Her nausea increased. The dialect had become unfamiliar. The way our wet throats bathed the words in the liquid of saliva was intolerable. A sense of repulsion had invested all the bodies in movement, their bone structure, the frenzy that shook them. How poorly made we are, she had thought. How insufficient. The broad shoulders, the arms, the legs, the ears, noses, eyes seemed to her attributes of monstrous beings who had fallen from some corner of the black sky. And the disgust, who knows why, was concentrated in particular on her brother Reno, the person who was closest to her, the person she loved most. She seemed to see him for the first time as he really was, a squat animal form, thick-set, the loudest, the fiercest, the greediest, the meanest. The tumult in her heart had overwhelmed her. She felt as if she were suffocating. Too smoky, too foul-smelling, too much flashing fire in the cold. Leela had tried to calm herself. She had said to herself, I have to seize the stream that's passing through me. I have to throw it out from me. But at that point she had heard, among the shouts of joy, a kind of final detonation, and something like the breath of a wing beat had passed by her. Someone was shooting not rockets and firecrackers, but a gun. Her brother Reno was shouting unbearable obscenities in the direction of the yellow flashes. On the occasion when she told me that story, Leela also said that the sensation she called dissolving margins, although it had come on her distinctly only that once, wasn't completely new to her. For example, she had often had the sensation of moving for a few fractions of a second into a person, or a thing, or a number, or a syllable, violating its edges. And the day her father threw her out the window, she had felt absolutely certain, as she was flying toward the asphalt, that small, very friendly reddish animals were dissolving the composition of the street, transforming it into a smooth, soft material. But that New Year's Eve, she had perceived for the first time unknown entities that broke down the outline of the world and demonstrated its terrifying nature.
This had deeply shaken her.
2. When Leela's cast was removed and her arm reappeared, pale but perfectly functioning, her father, Fernando, came to an agreement with himself and, without saying so directly, but through Reno and his wife, Nunzia, allowed her to go to a school to learn, I don't know exactly what, stenography, bookkeeping, home economics, or all three. She went unwillingly. Nunzia was summoned by the teachers because her daughter was often absent without an excuse, disrupted the class, if questioned, refused to answer, and if she had to do exercises, did them in 5 minutes, and then harassed her classmates. At some point, she got a nasty flu, she who never got sick, and seemed to welcome it with a sort of abandon, so that the virus quickly sapped her energy. Days passed, and she didn't get better. As soon as she tried to go out again, paler than usual, the fever returned. One day I saw her on the street, and she looked like a spirit. The spirit of a child who had eaten poisonous berries, such as I had seen illustrated in a book belonging to Maestra Oliviero. Later a rumor spread that she would soon die, which caused me an unbearable anxiety. She recovered, almost in spite of herself. But, with the excuse that her health was poor, she went to school less and less often, and at the end of the year she failed. Nor did I do well in my first year of middle school. At first I had great expectations, and even if I didn't say so clearly to myself, I was glad to be there with Giliola Spagnuolo rather than with Leela. In some very secret part of myself, I looked forward to a school where she would never enter, where, in her absence, I would be the best student, and which I would sometimes tell her about, boasting. But immediately I began to falter. Many of the others proved to be better than me. I ended up with Giliola in a kind of swamp. We were little animals, frightened of our own mediocrity, and we struggled all year not to end up at the bottom of the class. I was extremely disappointed. The idea began to quietly form that without Leela, I would never feel the pleasure of belonging to that exclusive group of the best. Every so often, at the entrance to school, I ran into Alfonso, the young son of Don Achille, but we pretended not to know each other. I didn't know what to say to him. I thought that Alfredo Peluso had done a good thing in murdering his father, and words of consolation did not come to me. I couldn't even feel moved by the fact that he had been orphaned. It was as if he bore some responsibility for the fear that for years Don Achille had inspired in me. He had a black band sewn on his jacket. He never laughed. He was always on his own. He was in a different class from mine, and the rumor was that he was really smart. At the end of the year, we found out that he had been promoted with an average of 8, which depressed me hugely. Giliola had to repeat Latin and mathematics. I managed to pass with 6s. When the grades came out, the teacher summoned my mother, told her in my presence that I had passed Latin only thanks to her generosity, and that without private lessons the next year I certainly wouldn't make it. I felt a double humiliation. I was ashamed because I hadn't done as well as I had in elementary school, and I was ashamed of the difference between the harmonious, modestly dressed figure of the teacher, between her Italian that slightly resembled that of the Iliad, and the misshapen figure of my mother, her old shoes, her dull hair, the dialect bent into an ungrammatical Italian. My mother, too, must have felt the weight of that humiliation. She went home in a surly mood. She told my father that the teachers weren't happy with me. She needed help in the house, and I ought to leave school.
They discussed it at length. They quarreled. And in the end, my father decided that, since I at least had been promoted while Giliola had been held back in two subjects, I deserved to continue. I spent the summer lethargically, in the courtyard, at the ponds, generally with Giliola, who often talked about the young university student who came to her house to give her private lessons, and who, according to her, was in love with her. I listened, but I was bored. Every so often, I saw Lila with Carmela Peluso. She too had gone to a school for something or other, and she too had failed. I felt that Lila no longer wanted to be my friend, and that idea brought on a weary exhaustion. Sometimes, hoping that my mother wouldn't see me, I lay down on the bed and dozed. One afternoon, I really fell asleep, and when I woke, I felt wet. I went to the bathroom to see what was wrong, and discovered that my underpants were stained with blood. Terrified by I don't know what, maybe a scolding from my mother for having hurt myself between my legs, I washed the underpants carefully, wrung them out, and put them on again wet. Then I went out into the heat of the courtyard. My heart was pounding. I met Lila and Carmela and walked with them to the parish church. I felt that I was getting wet again, but I tried to calm down by telling myself it was the wet underpants. When the fear became unbearable, I whispered to Lila, "I have to tell you something." "What?" "I want to tell just you." I took her by the arm, trying to drag her away from Carmela, but Carmela followed us. I was so worried that in the end I confessed to them both, but addressing only Lila. "What can it be?" I asked. Carmela knew all about it. She had had that bleeding for a year already, every month. "It's normal," she said. "Girls have it naturally. You bleed for a few days, your stomach and your back hurt, and then it goes away."
"Really?
Really?" Lila's silence pushed me toward Carmela. The naturalness with which she had said what she knew reassured me and made me like her. I spent all afternoon talking to her until dinner time. "You wouldn't die from that wound," I learned. "Rather, it means that you're grown up and you can make babies if a man sticks his thingy in your stomach." Lila listened without saying anything, or almost anything. We asked if she had blood like us, and saw her hesitate, then reluctantly answer no. Suddenly she seemed small, smaller than I had ever seen her. She was 3 or 4 inches shorter, all skin and bones, very pale, in spite of the days spent outside. And she had failed. And she didn't know what the blood was, and no boy had ever made a declaration to her. "You'll get it," we both said, in a falsely comforting tone. "What do I care?" she said. "I don't have it because I don't want to. It makes me sick, and anyone who has it makes me sick." She started to leave, but then stopped and asked me, "How's Latin?" "Wonderful." "Are you good at it?" "Very." She thought about it and muttered, "I failed on purpose. I don't want to go to any school anymore." "What will you do?" "Whatever I want." She left us there in the middle of the courtyard. For the rest of the summer, she didn't appear. I became very friendly with Carmela Peluso, who, although she laughed too much and then complained too much, had absorbed Lila's influence so potently that she became, at times, a kind of surrogate. In speech, Carmela imitated her tone of voice, used some of her recurring expressions, gesticulated in a similar way, and when she walked, tried to move like her, even though physically she was more like me, pretty and plump, bursting with health. That sort of misappropriation partly repulsed and partly attracted me. I wavered between irritation at a remake that seemed a caricature and fascination because, even diluted, Lila's habits still enchanted me. It was with those that Carmela finally bound me to her. She told me how terrible the new school had been. Everyone teased her, and the teachers couldn't stand her. She told of going to the prison of Poggio Reale with her mother and siblings to see her father, and how they all wept. She told me that her father was innocent, that it was a black creature who killed Don Achille, part male but mostly female, who lived with the rats and came out of the sewer grates, even in daytime, and did whatever terrible thing had to be done before escaping underground. She told me unexpectedly, with a fatuous little smile, that she was in love with Alfonso Caracci. Right afterward, her smile turned to tears. It was a love that tortured her and sapped her strength. The daughter of the murderer was in love with the son of the victim. It was enough for her to see him crossing the courtyard or passing by on the stradone to feel faint. This was a confidence that made a great impression on me and consolidated our friendship. Carmela swore that she had never talked about it to anyone, not even Lila. If she had decided to open up to me, it was because she couldn't bear to keep it inside anymore. I liked her dramatic tone. We examined all the possible consequences of that passion until school started again, and I no longer had time to listen to her. What a story. Not even Lila, perhaps, would have been able to make up such a tale. 3. A period of unhappiness began. I got fat, and under the skin of my chest, two hard shoots sprouted. Hair flourished in my armpits and my pubis, and I became sad and at the same time anxious. In school, I worked harder than I ever had, yet the mathematics problems almost never gave the result expected by the textbook. The Latin sentences seemed to make no sense. As soon as I could, I locked myself in the bathroom and looked at myself in the mirror, naked. I no longer knew who I was. I began to suspect that I would keep changing, until from me my mother would emerge, lame, with a crossed eye, and no one would love me anymore. I cried often, without warning. My chest, meanwhile, became large and soft. I felt at the mercy of obscure forces acting inside my body. I was always agitated. One day, as I came out of school, Gino, the pharmacist's son, followed me along the street and said that his classmates claimed that my breasts weren't real. I stuffed them with cotton batting. He laughed as he spoke. He said that he thought they were real. He had bet 20 lire on it. Finally, he said that if he won, he would keep 10 lire for himself and would give me 10. But I had to prove that I didn't use padding. That request frightened me. Since I didn't know how to act, I deliberately resorted to Lila's bold tone. Give me the 10 lire. Why? Am I right? Yes. He ran away, and I was disappointed. But soon he returned with a boy from his class, a skinny boy whose name I don't remember, with a dark down above his lip. Gino said to me, he has to be there, otherwise the others won't believe I've won. Again, I resorted to Lila's tone. First the money. And if you have padding? I don't. He gave me 10 lire, and we all went, silently, to the top floor of a building near the public gardens. There, next to the iron door that led to the terrace, where I was clearly outlined by slender segments of light, I lifted up my shirt and showed them my breasts. The two stood staring as if they couldn't believe their eyes. Then they turned and ran down the stairs. I heaved a sigh of relief and went to the Bar Solara to buy myself an ice cream. That episode remained stamped in my memory. I felt for the first time the magnetic force that my body exercised over men. But above all, I realized that Leela actually